Yes, then the recording should have started. I have to schedule the recordings. That's why I have to be very precise here. So how can we control these third variables or the confounding variables or whatever we call them? Well, there is a number of things, but everything has to do with controlling the situation in some kind of way. It can be done using statistical techniques. It can be done by applying experimental methods that controls for the third variables. That's what you do when you design experiments, where you have control groups that's similar to the experiment group. And they're exposed to the same changes. One is exposed to a change, one isn't. And that's one way of controlling for third variables. But the essence of this is that if you don't measure in some way, if you don't take into account, either by measurements or control them out in some way, the third variables or the confounding variables, if you don't do that, you will have a very difficult situation when you try to say something about causal relationships, whether one thing causes another thing, whether the independent variable is actually the right variable to explain the effect on the dependent variable. So when you measure something, measure all the possible other, or as many as possible of the other potential factors. So, like, if we were to measure the effect of this attitude campaign where we try to see if we can reduce speeding on the highway, well, make sure to measure the time of day when measurements were taken. Make sure to measure, well, let's say weather conditions. Maybe you should take a light reading or something like that, a measurement before you start to do your recordings. Maybe you should control for the number of cars on the road within the time period you measure. So if you don't do these things, you can't control for them. But if you do it, you may be able to actually just observe something and control for them statistically. And you don't have to do a very controlled experiment. There's a couple of other terms that we need to go through before we introduce the short paper you're going to write, because this is one of the terms that you're going to say something about when you read these papers, and that's the terms reliability and validity, which has to do with both how you perform some kind of a measurement or how you measure something, but it has also something to do with how you conclude from your measurements. Some of you may be very familiar with these terms, but they may mean a little bit. They may be a bit more specific when it comes to scientific methodology than in everyday language, because at least validity is something we tend to use now and then in normal language as well. Reliability in this case means the stability of the instrument we use for measurements. While validity has to do with, you could say, the accuracy of the instrument that we use. If we take an instrument as an example, a reliable speedometer on a car always shows you the same number every time you drive at a certain speed. So it's a reliable measurement there is that it always gives you the same number whenever you drive at a given speed. validity has to do whether that speed is correct or not. So maybe it is so that the speedometer shows 80, but the actual speed is 72 or something like that, which is very common. Then you have a reliable instrument that measures speed, but maybe you have a problem with validity because it isn't actually the real speed it's showing. So a meter stick that measures a meter or that measures 90 centimeters or something will be reliable, but it's not necessarily valid, or it isn't valid. To draw this relationship like this, where the ideal situation, of course, is a valid measurement that's also reliable. So every time you shoot this gun, you tend to meet the target here. And the measurements here are very condensed on the right target. It may be condensed, it may be correct, but it may also be outside the actual goal. This may be compensated for by theory or by adjustments, as long as you know how much off it is. Of course, then you can compensate for this, but you need to know that this is the case, and that's often the problem. You don't know the offset here. And then you have the least ideal situation. There is where the measurement isn't reliable and it isn't valid either. Of course, then it's more or less useless. But then again, you often have situations like this, where you have a measurement that tends to be a bit uncertain, like a number of questionnaires you give to people, or if you make people, well, let's say you are going to measure how fast they run, well, the time of day, or how well they've eaten, or if they've slept, or whatever, may affect this quite a lot, and that's not what we're after. And then this measurement may be a bit unreliable, while it tends to vary around the same target all the time. And that is something, again, we can compensate for, and the way to compensate for a situation like this, where you have a measure that isn't very reliable but kind of varies around the right target, is to take more measurements. Then the mean measurement tends to be where you are aiming. So it's there are ways to compensate for situation where you don't have this ideal thing, but you always have to consider whether you have a reliable and a valid measurement of the variables that you are including in the study. And in some cases, you also have to judge whether you have a valid conclusion from your studies, which is somewhat different. When you are, let's say you are using some kind of a questionnaire, which is a common thing where you have to judge reliability, several factors may affect the reliability of questionnaires. For instance, will different interviewers come out with the same type of answers? No, and then that's not the case, because they may have very small nuances between different interviewers may be very may affect the answers quite a lot. And this can be compensated for by letting several people do the interviews and check afterwards whether the interviewer had any effect on the results, because they shouldn't have any effect on the results. Retest reliability means would you, if you measured something again, would you get the same results? That may be a little bit difficult to check for, because doing one measurement may affect the next measurement. So it tends to be a very difficult thing to do, but then you have statistical techniques to help you doing this. And that is, for instance, doing some kind of what's called a split half measurement. You take a random sample of half the questions and you compare them. And if they're trying to measure the same thing, they should be similar. And that can also be done in a statistical way, where you take a measurement called Cronbach's alpha, which is the number of all possible split half coefficients you can make from a questionnaire. And that should be as high as possible. And if that is low, well, then you have a pretty unreliable instrument that where you can't be sure that you're actually measuring the same thing from each time you apply it. We will probably do some of this, at least we'll do some kind of a Cronbach's alpha, I guess, on some data later when I'm trying to demonstrate some data analysis, either group-wise or maybe I'll try to do it in plenum as well. When it comes to validity, I don't think I'll go very much in detail here, but there are different forms of validity as well. You have this construct validity, where you actually check whether the what you think that you're measuring is that are the terminologies that you use there, are they the correct ones? Do they refer to the right theory? Maybe in theory you're measuring something, but the actual case is that you measure something completely different. So there isn't a relationship between the explanations and theory you put into it compared to what you actually are measuring. And this is a threat to validity, because it is a threat to the conclusions that you come, where you are going to say something about cause-effect relationships. Well, there is an effect, but actually the explanation you give is wrong. Then you will have very low construct validity of the test. You can read more details about these yourself, but an important thing here is that you may have situations where most of the structured way of defining validity is failing, but where you still have a test that is useful. And a good example of this is a test that's developed for actually it's a psychological test that in theory was a test to measure psychological defense. Meaning that what they do is that they flash a picture before a child. That is where it was developed. So the construct is that this has to do with psychological defense, how long you're willing to suppress some threats before you see it. That's the theory. That's a construct. And it also seems like a relevant thing. So it has face validity, for instance. What they do there is that they flash pictures in front of children. It is a very simple picture, and the first that you see, it's exposed very fast, and then masked out with some sub-mask afterwards, so you don't have an after image. And the first thing you see is that you see a girl leaning forward, reading something, or drawing or something like that, on the desk in front of her. And then you expose the subject to longer and longer exposures of that picture. And in the end, she is supposed to see the threat figure. And that the dependent variable is how long do you need the exposure to be to see the threat figure, which is a man standing over the child like that. So it has face validity. It's based on maybe erroneous, but anyway, it's based on a construct which we believe is there. But in this case, what now then is done is that we want to validate tests like this, so we want to use them on a very controlled population to see how the normal population scores, to say something about extremes. And one group that this is done on a lot is in the military. So a lot of the tests we have are done on subjects that are going through screening procedures for military purposes, for selection purposes. And in this case, they used this for people that were screened to be pilots. They were actually a long way up in this ladder as well. They were selected pilots, so this was some kind of a rerun of a test later in their educational program. And of course, these should be quite good at this. But what came out as a surprise some years later was that when they measured these pilots' likelihood to be involved in some kind of a situation, either they had ejected or they had been very close to some accident, what's actually came out as the best predictor for that accident or for that situation was whether these pilots had a high psychological defense. So those who saw this threat figure very late, it hasn't anything to do with piloting, right? But those who saw this threat figure very late, they were more likely to be involved in accidents. And of course, this wasn't a test that was used to select these pilots, and there were no theory to explain this. Because what they measure these pilots to do is how good are they at doing things simultaneously, how fast are they in interpreting information. And this seems to be unrelated to that. But it came out as the best predictor we have for how good, potentially good pilots are at coping with stressful situations. So, it isn't valid. It doesn't have face validity. It didn't have face validity before we actually saw what happened. So, even though we have tests that fail somewhat on these basic validity issues, it maybe have very high what we call predictive validity anyway. So if we measure something against some goal, well, maybe things comes out differently than we thought it would do. There are other, when it comes to conclusions, we tend to use other terms for validity. Maybe this is more relevant when you are going to say something about validity in your this short assignment you have. And that is whether you have internal and external validity of your study. And when we refer to something as internally valid, it means that the conclusions you get from the experiment actually is true. There is, in your experimental setting, a relationship between what you manipulated and what you measured. So you have described the right connection. Then you have high internal validity. And that is a prerequisite for external validity, of course. But external validity has to do with more with generalizability of your findings. Can you actually relate to the real world here? Is this valid also outside the experimental context that we have created? Then we have, if it is, then we also have external validity. But in Norwegian, then, if we are going to use words for validity and reliability, or the other way around, reliability and validity, we tend to say stabilitet og gyldighet. If that helps some of you. And when it comes to the relationship again between between validity and reliability, and especially then for tests, you can say that to have a valid test, you need to have a reliable test as well. But even if you have a reliable test, it doesn't necessarily lead you to valid conclusions. So a valid test must be reliable, but a reliable test need not to be valid. But reliability is the key element here. So establish reliability before you try to establish validity. That's one of the lessons learned for many when they do experiments. They start with the big picture, and then it's too fussy to actually say something about this. So unless you have a good instrument to measure something in the first place, and unless you spend time in developing this instrument, you tend also to fail when you are going to draw conclusions in your study. Okay, spend the rest of the time. I'm going to present one of these papers quite fast. This is your assignment for, and this is to be delivered by next week. You will find two short papers in your, or in the resources folder in the front room. I think they're linked to as well. One of them, an article from the Journal of Improbable Research, which is a source for you can say well done and argumented for science on silly topics, more or less. You can find a lot of very nice studies there. Does a cat always land on its feet, and they actually done it? And in this case, you will find an article where they are measuring a common saying among Americans. I guess we have something like this in Norwegian as well. Flat men pannekake. But in America, they have this saying that the Kansas is flatter than a pancake. So these scientists try to measure this. Is it flatter than a pancake? And in this article, along with another article that I'm going to present to you in a short while now, your task is to identify the two types of variables that are involved. It may be straightforward, it may also be, some of you may make it a bit complicated. Feel free to do that. It is possible. But it may also be quite straightforward to say what's the dependent and the independent variable in this case. So for both of these short papers, you're going to do this. And you're also going to say something about the operationalization of the variables that are involved. Which variables that is referred to in the title or in the problem description is operationalized further and made into a detailed statement, a measurable statement. And maybe, and that, I guess that goes more for this one, what should we have operationalized more in detail? And I also wanted to reflect a little bit about reliability and validity of the work they have done there. And when it comes to validity, it's maybe especially this thing about internal and external validity that I'm after. Slutningsvaliditet på norsk. Validity of the conclusions that's involved. A very short thing, 3 pages, no more. So it's not going to be good prose or something like that. It's very concrete. You can take them together or you can do them sequentially. That's up to you. But I expect a bit more than just 3 sentences saying something about this. Reflect a little bit about it as well. I'm going to... these things are going to be... this is a pass or no pass thing, so it's not going to be graded. But I need to check out that you have some basic understanding of the terminology and how to analyze or how to find these things in scientific writing. So it's a checkout thing. If you fail in the first run, you will get another chance, so don't worry. No one will... I don't expect anyone to get into a situation where they can't take exam because they can't pass this one, right? I will just tell you to redo it. You can redo this one. And delivered by next week. Next Wednesday. I think I put the deadline to midnight or something, so you can do it after the lecture, maybe next week. No. Yeah. No, nothing. I can't. I'm not, I just make it readable to me. Yeah. So anything that falls within the range font 10 to 14 will do. 12 is perfect, right? And the format you deliver in, I'd like it to be PDF, but if you can't make a PDF, make it into something else that I can read. Some of the open desktop formats may be a bit challenging from Fronti, so maybe you can, if you can do PDFs, that would be fine. That was a few words about the requirements. And of course, it's not a bad thing if you format it like somewhat like scientific writing. Scientific essay. Now, one of these paper is some stuff I have been involved with or was involved with a few years ago, together with some other teachers here. A study where we wanted to see how people reacted to the use of computers during class. It was both a descriptive study of usage, how much was used, and it was a study of the perceived effect of these computers and their usage during class. It was done here. And of course, the background for this is that more and more we see that people are, of course, using computers, and that's something most of us actually wants you to do. But there are a lot of worries about the effect of this. Will you become more distracted? What are you doing on these computers? And how does this use affect others? Of course, another background thing here is that it is more or less unavoidable now. We're used to this. We have access to the net. And whether we do that on computers, or we do it on iPhones, or whether we do it on pads or whatever, it's not really important. But we're used to be on net, so yeah, we are being distracted, or we do things that's not necessarily always relevant for what's being taught in class. But anyway, even if this is the case, maybe it is so that some types of usage of computers during class is more distracting than others. And maybe that is important to say something about what we should try to say to students about how they should use computers during class, for instance. So this was pretty much the background for this study. And what we did was that we asked a number of students, 210 in total, over 2 years. First in 2007, and then we, for a paper, redid this a little some years later as well, just to see whether the effects were the same as we measured the first time, to get some more data and to control for potential changes over time, because this was a period where things did change a lot. This was the period where iPhones and pads came into the picture, for instance. So what we did was that after class, and this came of course as a surprise, or it wasn't announced for students, but after class they were given a questionnaire that had two versions. One was a version where we asked a number of questions to the users of computers, and the other one was slightly different, and that was for non-users during class. And what we saw there was that in total some one-third of the students around that were using computers during these classes. More in some classes, less in some. If you take a look around you now, you are pretty much in the middle here. I guess a third of you are looking at laptops now. But of course, what we wanted to see was whether the use you actually have of these laptops are perceived differently if I ask questions to the observers, the non-users, compared to the users here. Uninformed. Different classes, different types of students. One of the classes was without a single user, so and one class for computer or for some informatics students was a class where 80% used it or something like that. So the variation was quite large. So what we asked then was a number of questions that had to do with attitudes towards and reactions on computer usage during lectures in general and in their class. And we compared, you could say, users with non-users during class. What we also did was that well, both users and non-users were rating how much, because they relevant academic activities they observed and or did themselves compared to what we can call academic irrelevant activities. Academic relevant activities was looking at course relevant web pages, learning management systems, pages that are referred to during class, etc. You get the picture of that. Looking at PowerPoints and stuff like that. That's what we called relevant academic activities, and we compared that to general browsing, looking at news, playing games, things like that. But before I take the results there and the differences between users and non-users, well, we saw that what had changed during the years from 2007, for instance, to 2011 was that in 2011 there were hardly any students who said that they didn't use it because they didn't have access to it. So it was either because it wasn't encouraged, or that you actually yourself perceived it as contra effective or something like that. Because that may be the case. A lot of students, a lot of you choose not to use it. But all of you, I guess, now as well, have access to the computer, so you can say that you don't use it because I don't have access. So that was somewhat a control variable here. So this is one of the changes that has taken place. There were some other effects as well. Those who were computer users during class also were more likely to be using computers extensively outside class. So there is a relationship between what you do in class and what you do in everyday activities. But now comes the interesting thing. If we ask, if we look at the blue one here is academic relevant usage, and this one is non-academic usage. The computer users, they perceived that they used, you could say, more, that they used their computers for academic relevant activities more than average, if you compare the two groups. While they used it very little for academic irrelevant activities, while for the non-users, this is the other way around. The non-users observe a lot of academic irrelevant activities compared to the non-users. So there is some kind of a discrepancy here in how people are using, are perceiving usage. And I'll get to the interpretation of this. 'Cause what we also saw was that no matter whether you were a computer user or not, most people say that computer use in class in general, that's something that doesn't affect me. Some nearly or 75% is in this category of all, or this is only the... Now I think this is all, actually. This is the total material. So the general thing is that computer use seems to be something that everybody accepts. It's not a problem. But entertainment use, is that disturbing? Well, yes, of everybody, there is some 80-something percent who says that, yes, it is disturbing when people use it for other purposes during class. So how do we interpret this? Well, we interpret it as a high, you could say that the visual noise created by irrelevant use during class is extremely salient, and it catches attention quite easily from others. So it's not, of course, it's not a big surprise, but it's something we thought was a good conclusion here, that when you sit on row 2, 3 or something and play a quick computer game or browse some Facebook pages, people may be very sensitive to that and may actually react to that quite easily. So what we say is that in the conclusion here is that this is a strong attention grabber, and you as students during class should be aware of it, and we as teachers should maybe spend some 10 minutes to say this when we start a series of lectures or something. So just to remind you. But of course, what we also do here in this conclusion is to say that this goes for classroom usage, but when we're discussing this in generalizability terms, maybe it also goes for other situations that we're in. We're sitting in open offices more and more, and we're sitting in meetings maybe more and more. At least that's what we feel. So this probably also goes for these types of situations. Computer usage is kind of a visual noise, and it's a very strong attention grabber for us. And this was a short paper we presented on the conference, and you can find the paper on the resources folder in front as well. So this is the other paper you're going to analyze then, the paper that I based this presentation on. Okay, task taken. Okay, delivered in 1 week's time. Thanks.